Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet and you meet.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street.
Aggressive people exist. They exist and they threaten us. Defense and Homeland Security is our government's top job. But our attempts, listen to this closely, our attempts to police the world with force and threats of force are seriously flawed and financially wasteful. The bad guys, as practical historian Bruce Thatcher, are probably adamant aggressors. He is the author of Adamant Aggressors, How to Recognize and Deal with Them. And as a matter of fact, he's developed the three-point identification system outlined in his book, Adamant Aggressors, How to Recognize and Deal with Them. Bruce, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Glad to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, in today's world, especially with the confusion that's going on, realistically, what you're saying here is absolutely true, because we don't recognize who the bad guys are, and the steps that we take to cover any kind of a challenge that we have are usually the wrong step. We end up spending hundreds of billions of dollars on security, etc., and in the end result, we've wasted our time because it's not the guy who we thought it was in the first place.
Well, that's right. And in the book, I point out that adamant aggressors, it's very important to understand that they're persons. They're not countries. We like to talk about countries threatening us, but it's people who are threatening us who may have the resources of countries to do that. We need to identify the people, and we need to look at the potential aggressors and begin by asking three questions. What's their real goal? Not what they say, not what other people say, but what really are they trying to accomplish? Is that a very enduring thing? Has it not changed over time? And are they willing to use any ends or any means to achieve their ends? If the answers to those questions are yes, then we've probably identified an adamant aggressor.
Okay, but I think the problem that we run into, Bruce, and it's a problem that we've had for probably the last 20 or 30 years, let's say we identify someone, the process that we have to go through to go after them, our hands are tied almost any which way you look at it. You know, we identify someone, so we decide to go after them. What do we do when we go after them? Are they a criminal? Are they a military threat? I mean, this list goes on. Do you try him here? Do you try him there? And if you go after him, who's going to get sued?
Well, going after him, actually, if you look at the guidelines for dealing with adamant aggressors, you'll at least eliminate a lot of the wrong things to do. The guidelines point out that the very first thing we need to do is clearly understand our own long-term interests and where the aggressor's goals threaten those interests. And we generally don't do that. You hear people, pundits and politicians talk about America's interests, but they don't ever define what those interests are in such a clear and unambiguous way that there's no possibility of mistaking them. They nuance it so that they don't hurt anybody's feelings. Once you identify the interests, then you can identify where the aggressor's interests are against ours, and you really come up against a really two-part question or decision. You either agree to stop the aggressor, or else you agree to give up your own goals and national interests. Those are your only two options. Once you've done that, then you can look at some of the behavior characteristics that let you deal with the aggressors. The first thing is to realize that these people often, particularly, they don't think like we do. They're only going to stop and back off on what they believe they want when they really truly believe they can't succeed, and that talks about some of the things we might do, or when they die. Yeah. We need to deal from a position of strength always and realize in this process that any concession we make absolutely guarantees renewed conflict at a future time, because adamant aggressors don't ever compromise and agree not to do it. They only compromise to gain a little bit and then remarshal their forces.
No, absolutely. And they're very true to their goals, true to their forces. I think, again, one of the biggest problems that we have today, by the way, I think you're spot on. I really believe in all of the experience I've had, of all the interviews I've done, my own personal experience out in the world today, I think what you have here is rock solid. History will repeat itself. If we look back in history, it will allow us to see some of the indicators, quote-unquote symptoms, of what an aggressor is today. But the problem we run into, again, what if an aggressor was somebody high in the governmental administration? You know that they're this. You know what the problems are. You see the changes that are happening. And if you go after them, you're every kind of a bigot, a racist, you're this, you're that, and you hate people. And that in and of itself is one of the things that's going to cause this country to get diluted. You said it. We need somebody tough enough to say, you don't mess with us, and if you do, we're going to come and get you. We've lost that somewhere.
I think we have lost that in many cases. The leader, and you can see this in history too, but the leader has to decide, or the person who has the power to do something about it has to decide whether they are really interested in the country or whether they're really interested in their political longevity, because taking the actions sometimes that need to be taken is very politically risky. It may mean that you get retired early.
No question about it. But the idea is to take the steps to do so. And my contention is this: how do you create that piece and part of government, that facet that will do this? Because it has to run through, obviously, the administration. You do it on a side note, you're in major trouble here. So how do you change things around so we can actually do what you're talking about doing? Because I'd be the first in line to say I'm with you.
Well, I think where it starts is understanding the reality of adamant aggressors in this particular lesson of history. Truly understanding our leaders, so many of them, you listen to the radio, the television, and they seem to think that the best approach to handling a problem of a potential aggressor or enemy is to somehow or other make the problem go away for a while, kick it down the road so that they don't have to handle it. I think that part of the reason that happens is because so many people don't even understand that adamant aggressors really, truly, genuinely mean us harm, and that they absolutely have to face them in order to do anything about it. Facing them doesn't necessarily mean you bomb them, but facing them means analyzing who they are and what will actually work in causing them to stop their adamant aggressor behavior, to come to believe that they can't succeed. And until the politician, the pundit, the political scientist, whoever it is, until they first understand that an adamant aggressor is not just a casual commercial competitor, until they understand that, then I don't think they're likely to begin behaving in the way they need to for the well-being of our country.
Now, by the way, we have that inside and we have that outside. And if you look at what's going outside, some of those adamant aggressors are very obvious, the Ahmadinejads and the rest of them. You can see that. And obviously, whatever we've done has not stopped their movement forward with nuclear weapons and so on and so forth. Then we have them inside the country. Let me ask you this. If you were the king of America, okay, well, Bruce, we're going to make you the leader that everybody has to do what you say to do. How would you fix it here?
Well, if I was the king of America, the first thing I would do is to draw up a list of potential adamant aggressors and really do the analysis to identify which ones are really dangerous, which, you know, who's really an adamant aggressor. Not every antagonist or competitor is an aggressor, but some are. I would put that list, I would make that list, and I'd put the CIA on it or whoever, and do the analysis to say, is this guy or gal really an adamant aggressor, or are they somebody else that you can deal with differently? And you'd come up, you know, you'd start with names like the Ayatollah Khamenei in, or Ahmadinejad in Iran. You would come up with maybe some people in Saudi Arabia or China, certainly North Korea. You'd come up with these names, and you would find out whether or not they truly are adamant aggressors. Once you've done that, then based upon each one individually, you've got to say, what do we have to do? You have to have a program, a specific program for dealing with them in an effective way, because it's not one program fits all. You can see in the book how different things were done with different adamant aggressors, and some things worked, most things didn't. But they weren't all military. And they don't necessarily all be military. But one thing you absolutely know, and I would make it absolutely a source for getting fired, is to respond to an adamant aggressor by making some general or vague threat and then not following through on it. Because that is the clearest sign to your opponent that you are weak, that they don't need to pay any attention to you.
Okay, but who can you give this to in our government today that would take advantage of that? And I know that's that sounds like a really loaded question, and I'm not trying to put you up against the wall, but where do we start with this? How do we put that book, your book, in the hands of the people that would read it and take some kind of action?
I think that the people in today's government, and I'm going to answer not pretending that we can wait till an election. Today means it's an executive branch decision, which means that our president has to be the one who means this. If he doesn't want to deal with it, then you're talking about people like the Defense Department, Secretary of Defense. You're talking about people in the intelligence community, people who can influence the president in ways that can get these kinds of things done. But the State Department, everybody who deals in foreign relations and defense has to understand these things, so that when they sit down in the Oval Office or in the Ready Room, they can say, okay, here's this guy or here's this guy, here's the research we have on him, and this says what we have to do, and Mr. President, give us the okay to do it.
Yeah, no, I think that's really the way to go. We're just about out of time now, but before we do, I just happened to glance at your bio. Semper Fi.
Semper Fi, thank you. You too.
Yeah, you bet. Me too. All right, by the way, now, a website we can find you at to get the book and find out more.
The website is called www.historyspeakstoday.com. And the website outlines the concept and also takes you to this book, gives you a lot, the book Adamant Aggressors, How to Recognize and Deal with Them, gives you a lot of teasers and hints on what's inside the book and shows you how to buy it. It's available online at xlibris.com, also amazon.com, Barnes & Nobles, and any online book dealer.
They got you. And I hear you loud and clear. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I love what you got here.
Well, thank you for having me, Michael Ray.
Take care. Good night.
Good night now.
I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Sienna, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Jillian Moss Beckman with us. She's the author of Beyond the Pews, Breaking with Traditional and the Letting Go and the Letting Go of the Religious Lockdown. And as a matter of fact, she's a minister's daughter. She's an intuitive coach, psychology major, and award-winning radio personality. Brings to readers another viewpoint on religion, spirituality, intuition, and love from the soul. She combines her life experiences along with a lifetime of learning into an interactive biography. And that's her first book, Beyond the Pews. It's out now, Breaking with Tradition and Letting Go of Religious Lockdown. Hey, Jillian, welcome back.
That's a handful, huh?
Yeah, I got through
it,
though.
It's a long title. Thank you, Michael, for having me back.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, when we really take a look at it, most people, they live their lives based on what their family taught them, what they learned in school, and they go through life with an assumption of how the world should be. Many people, whether it has to do with religion or just living your life, Jillian, they live their life based on something called an assumption. And an assumption is something very interesting because it's an assumption with an incontestable conclusion. So they take it on as fact. And then what happens? They're living their life in this reality that doesn't exist, and they get in a lot of trouble, and they don't know why they don't feel good about themselves.
Yeah, exactly, and very well put. You know, that's why I named it Beyond the Pews, because a lot of people, exactly what you're saying, don't want to look beyond what's right in front of them. And, you know, that's okay for some people, but life is meant to be learned through lessons. And when you quit taking on new lessons, you're not growing. And I think in this area especially, this is very slow to change. This is very one of those areas that people, you know, don't want to talk about or don't want to touch because they're not willing to look beyond what they know what's right in front of them and what they're comfortable with.
Or what they don't know that's in front of them. You know, if exactly what you're talking about when we talk about life lessons. You know, it's not this, when somebody's going to get a lesson, it's not this biblical thing that gets in front of you, then you get this awe-inspiring, I got it. A life lesson can be as simple as loss of a job, breaking up of a relationship. And a prime example of this, and I've told this story a couple times on the air, but this is, the timing is good, this is perfect. There's a woman that I know that was in college and she wanted to be a professional athlete. And her coach said to her, no, you don't have what it takes to be that. So instead of her taking it and living with it and destroying herself about it, she said, oh no, I'm going to prove you wrong. And she ran out and she found herself another coach who worked with her, and she became the professional athlete, and she went on to become a professor of athletics at a particular university here. Now, here's the lesson in it. Somebody said no to her, and she went on anyways. The coach that she got to teach her, that caused her to be a professional athlete, she ended up marrying this guy. Yes. And if the coach had said to her, you're lousy, and she would have given up, she'd have never met her husband of 20, 30 years.
So true, right? And the whole book is on that, that the idea is that you just go with your intuition, and it sounds like she just followed her gut on that. And how many times have we heard people say that? But the reality is, everybody gets messages like that, Michael, but they don't have the wherewithal or the techniques to follow through and trust that gut. And that's what I wrote about in the book. And the book is in perfect alignment and timing with what's going on in the world because people are in pain. They're confused and they have conflict. But the one free resource that everybody keeps overlooking is that own intuitive knowing that we have inside ourselves that we know what we're supposed to be doing. But I think the book is just going out the door, flying off the shelves. It's because I've taken my years and years of practice with my private clients, thrown that first time in this book as an interactive workbook along with my own story to back up what I'm talking about. And I think timing is, as you said, very crucial, and never to say no, never to give up.
You see, I think the biggest problem that we all have, and I say we all because we're all part of the human race, is that if I get myself in a position that I've never been before and I don't know what to do, I don't care how old I am, how much experience I have, I need somebody looking over my shoulder, looking at things through a different set of eyes that sees what I don't see, that proverbial blind spot, that whatever it is to a solution that you can't find. And the big problem is we have nobody to say, give me your hand and I'm going to take you through this step by step by step. That's why when you deal with your soul work and you have lessons planned and beyond the pews, lesson plans, and so an average person can walk through it step by step by step instead of saying, oh, you got a challenge, you know, the best thing you can do is go through the challenge and meet it and you'll get something. Yeah, right, sure. But give me, exactly.
And, you know, everybody talks about living a spiritual life. And what confuses me about that is what we're talking about is spirituality. It's about making mistakes. It's about changing your life. It's about doing different things. And in the book, I talk about this notion, of the sixth sense and how it's separate from ourselves. And I, in the book, talk about how our soul work goes through all the five senses. So the point of the exercise is I think a lot of people are doing spiritual work, and what I mean by that is they know what their soul's supposed to do. They just haven't labeled it. Or they're missing the special moments that come through simplicity. You know, everybody talks about looking for that aha moment. Like this story you just gave, she didn't have an aha moment. She had a moment of, wait a minute, I'm going to back the train up and go a different direction at it. And that's what the book talks about, how to keep on living and expanding into that soul sense of yourself and listening to that inner voice. I think people are afraid of it.
Oh, absolutely, because the inner voice might tell me I can do something that somebody hasn't given me permission to do, which I think is...
You bet!
Yeah, and we need permission.
Yeah, and I think they're afraid of the power, Michael.
Oh, absolutely. What is that? I think I've said this 1,000 times, and I'll say it 1,000,000 more just to get it across. There's too many people that they'd rather be unhappy than uncertain.
Yeah, and I think in the other part of the story is trust. And I think that's where the religious part really comes in the book. In other words, you can expand from that religious experience that you have as a child or do you have now. It is a good structure for people to build upon. And in the book, people really want me to choose a side. And I'm not going to do that. I refuse to call myself a religious person, and I refuse to call myself a spiritualist because I think the whole thing is one big pile of greatness.
And it depends on the path you decide. It's the fit. When it really comes down to it, it's called what fits. What are you comfortable with? There are people who love to live within the confines, the context of the set of rules, and they're frightened to death to step out. Again, better unhappy than unsure. Or there are the people who just say, let it come. Just open it up. I got that. And that's when you expand and you grow.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I really believe that people are ready. You know, before when I started this industry over 15 years ago in the wellness, I don't think people were ready. But if you look around, the last holdouts of the real systems and structures is this whole religious spiritual area. In other words, the politicians are learning that conflict doesn't work. They have to compromise. Our economic system is looking at a world view. We are all ready, and the timing is right for us to start moving into that place of really going inward and living more of a soul life. Because people keep asking me, how can you be so optimistic when everything's crumbling on around us? Well, the reality is, when you live a life like I live, those parts are just a part of the process that we all have to go through to be more soulful living. And if you're going to turn anywhere, you better turn there.
Absolutely. And I think realistically, we're losing our belief in ourself. And I don't mean...
Yeah,
that's exactly what it is. But look at all the messages that come through the media. They're mixed messages. They're confusing messages. And people are confused. They don't even know what an American is anymore. And in a world like that with such chaos, the kids running around and, you know, demonstrating against this, and we're starting to look like the Middle East and parts of Europe anymore with what's going on, that in and of itself has got to tell you, in this general sense of the word, you, that we've lost ourselves. And it's time that we came back, because if we don't, there's going to be some big problems here.
Yeah, and you know, I've always been saying in the last year when I've been talking about the book, we have to go through deconstruction to get to reconstruction. There's no way around that. And intuitively, we've been doing that for the last 5 years. And I'm getting ready to write my intuitive thoughts for 2012. And, of course, that's a big issue for everybody. And the word that keeps coming through meditation for me is buoyancy. And this book is about how to write yourself, even when you're underwater. As we know, a buoy always rights itself straight up and gets vertical and sits where it needs to sit to be efficient. It never goes down under, and when it does, it comes back up. That's where we're at. But I think that people need to understand the personal responsibility to find that soul work within themselves that will help them be more buoyant through all of this.
Well, I think what's going to happen also, now I'm not a biblical scholar, I'll tell you that right up front, but there are things that I'm aware of over the years, being, you know, being on this side of the microphone, the different things that I've heard, that in 2012 is supposed to be the it's when everything stops here. And the world in and itself turns. It's the, what? Help me, Jillian, I'm searching for this word. What's supposed to happen in 2012?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot, the spiritualists are using the word ascension. The religious community is, you know, I'm not sure, I can't remember that word either. Aren't we crazy?
I'll call you at 4 o'clock in the morning when I remember the word.
Exactly, after I get off this phone call, we'll get together on it.
Okay, now, but the important thing is this. The end of days, or whatever the case may be, but that's supposed to be in early November 2012, and the election here is the same time. So it's going to be very interesting to see the ramifications of the election for president, whoever you want to be president, doesn't really matter. But that I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens, because November 2012 is going to be a very interesting date in the world history.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's the same way the book is, meaning, are we going to take it literally or figuratively? You know, and I think that's the part that I'm going to be writing about in the next couple weeks. And in the book, it's about what is it really going to entail? And the reality is, are you going to live your life differently today because it may end next year? And if you answer yes to that question, maybe you need to relook at what you're doing anyway.
Absolutely. Wouldn't it be interesting, and I've said this for years, What if you knew that at midnight tonight it was over? You were going to die. The world is over and it's done. How different would your decisions be? How much emphasis would you place on certain things in your life? And what would be important to you? And all of a sudden, all those little things that are bothering you wouldn't make a whole lot of sense, would they?
Right. And you'd make different choices. And I think that's the whole point of the exercise. People are really starting, and I give people credit, even though I hear all this drama and all this sad that's going on, through the book, I've been able to see through the eyes of the public. They really want to do different things. They really want to be better people, better parents, better partners, better community leaders. But they don't know where to start. And I think that's why the book is popping so much, is because I put it down into a language that everybody can duplicate and get, you know, what they want out of it.
No question.
I'm excited for that part.
Okay, now we're starting, Jillian, we're starting to run out of time. So can we get your website where we can get the book and find out more about what you're doing?
Yeah, sure. You know, I'm on book tour all over America, and so I'll be in the South and everything else. But my website is www.JillianMossBackman.com, JillianMossBackman. And the name of the book is called Beyond the Pews, Breaking with Tradition and Letting Go of Religious Lockdown. And, of course, it's on Amazon, and if you're in the Milwaukee area, it's at Boswell Books and all different bookstores all over America. So I would encourage everyone, it's a great Christmas gift. A lot of people are getting it for Christmas. So thank you for having me on again.
Oh, Jillian, thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure. Take care. Good night.
Yeah, good night.
And the only heart I own for you and you alone, that's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. Charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Ken Ginsberg with us, the co-author of Letting Go with Love and Confidence, Raising Responsible, Resilient, Self-Sufficient Teens in the 21st Century. Ken Ginsberg, MD, is a pediatrician, specializing in adolescent medicine at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He also serves as the director of health sciences at Covenant House, Pennsylvania, an agency that serves Philadelphia's homeless and marginalized youth. And let's say, Ken, hi, welcome to the show. Ken, can you hear me? We're here. Are you there?
Hello?
Well, hopefully, I guess I can. Well, what happened? All right, we got it.
Hello?
Oh, there you are, Ken.
I'm here.
We thought we lost you.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me okay?
I'm hearing you're going in and out, but I'm on a normal phone, but it's raining outside.
Ah, okay. Oh, where are you calling from? What part of the country?
Philadelphia.
Ah, Philadelphia is a good place. Well, I don't know if you heard me or not, but I talked about your bio and also the title of the book. And the title of the book really in and of itself says a lot. Letting Go with Love and Confidence, Raising Responsible, Resilient, Self-Sufficient Teens in the 21st Century. How do you do that without a lot of Prozac?
The first thing you have to realize is that parenting a teenager is actually a very special and wonderful time in life, and that we spend so much time vilifying teenagers that we forget what a joy it is to launch people into adulthood. At the same time, you're right, the title does say a lot. You know, we're so good at trying to hold on tight, and there's all these books out there that tell us how to raise children, which is holding on tight and making the perfect child. But there's very little out there that really tells us or prepares us for the anguish sometimes of letting go as we launch them into adulthood.
Oh, sure. No question about it. And as a matter of fact, but raising them to begin with, Ken, today, and especially in today's world, you know, if you go back 20, 30, 40 years, teenagers were different. There was a completely different respect for parents and school and so on and so forth, which we don't have to get into. But it's a little different mindset. It's a little different world today. Not only do they have what the parents think, but it's the peer group, it's the school, and it goes on and on and on. And politics, for whatever reason, seem to have an effect on teenagers today. So you've got all of those variables that come into play that you have to be able to cut right through to get right to the center of touching them so they become that kid that will make it in the world.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to think about what it's going to take to make a kid become authentically successful in the world. But let me say that our parents, you know, I'm almost 50. I have two 16-year-old girls myself. Our parents thought that raising us was different than the generation before. What has always been is that it's been kids' jobs to become independent, to learn to stand on their own. There's nothing new about that. What's exciting about this book is that what it's really about is helping parents honor kids' independence so that kids don't end up rebelling against us. Instead, they understand that we're on their side. We want to help them navigate a really complicated world so that they'll stand on their own, with the ultimate goal of having them work with us instead of rebelling against us, and the really ultimate goal is having them become independent while being interdependent with us in a healthy family.
Well, I think the operative word there is interdependent, because most kids today, I think a lot of the technology has to do with it. There's nothing that they don't know anymore that they can't hit a button and find out. I didn't say they think they knew. They do know. They have the ability to learn everything about anything at any time they want to learn it. And the older parent doesn't keep up with them, quote unquote. So what does the parent know? If I'm a kid and I know more than my parents, I'm going to lose, in the general sense of the word, I'm going to lose some respect here. So the parent has got to get and gain that respect, because if the kid, the children, the teenagers, boy or girl, if they can't be accepted at home or don't feel that they're accepted, they don't have that identity, they're going to go someplace else for it.
You're right on target. So our job to raise kids who are ready to be independent is to help them master each piece of their environment, each developmental tasks they have. And you picked one that's a perfect thing to talk about for a moment. So, yeah, they do understand technology. I can't operate my TV if my girls aren't home. That's a fact, okay? But it is why there's a stepwise approach to helping them master any new task as they move towards independence. And the first step is always observe. We don't know their world. We don't know what Facebook is like. We don't know what it's like to go to the mall with all the hypersexual attention that's paid to 14-year-olds. We don't know that anymore. And just as when we were, our kids were 2 years old, we got down on our knees to see, when we were baby-proofing the house, to see what the world looked like from their vantage point, the first thing we do is we observe. But then the way we create mutual respect is we don't tell them what to do then. Then we listen, and we understand that they are the experts in their lives, particularly around the new technologies. And when we understand that they're the experts, and then we're just suggesting that we offer some guidance to get them through the bumps, that can create interdependence rather than rebellion.
No, absolutely. And with everything that you mentioned with the 14-year-old girls are exposed to, with everything the kids are exposed to today, it's very hard for a parent to sit down and you know, like the old days, let's talk about sex, let's talk about this, let's talk about that. It's already out there, and there are mindsets. And I think a parent today has a job that is so far different than a parent in your day or a parent in my day. I'm the generation or two before you, and it was a completely different world out there, and it's scary.
So it's challenging, but it's always been challenging. It's always been about navigating a world that is new and strange and about becoming independent. So we must accept the fact that the world's different, but not get psyched out and say that we have no experience to prepare us for that. We rebelled against our parents to learn to stand on our own. We struggled, and whether our struggles were a little bit different, we've still been through it, and we know what it felt like. We have to remember that, and we have to remember how much we appreciated it when people stood by us and valued our knowledge, honored our independence, and just wanted us to succeed, versus if we had very controlling parents who basically say, you'll do it, why? Because I said so. Then we rebelled, and, you know, I'm almost 50. I rebelled when I got those messages, and I'll bet you if I met someone who was 120 and someone said, you'll do it, trust me, you don't have any decision-making ability yourself, that person would have rebelled 100 years ago. What's scarier, a little bit, is the world.
The world
can be a little bit more dangerous.
Wait, you didn't grow up in the 50s. Mom and Dad said it, you shut up and you did it. But that was a whole world ago. But that's true. And one of the things that, you know, in your talking points, which I think is extremely important, I happen to glance at it here, why it's never too late to change your parenting style. You could have a kid that's 22 years old, and if it hadn't worked before, if you change your parenting style, even if they're an adult and in and out of the house, it still creates that communication. What I'm hearing is, The core of this is the ability to communicate with those kids on a level that you're both coming from the same frame of reference.
Absolutely. The key is listening so that the kid understands that you're actually hearing and talking so that they will know that you're on their side, and coming together where they know that your goal is for them to become independent, and for that, but your goal also is to keep them safe and prepare them for success so that they know that the freedoms that they get are directly related to the responsibilities that they demonstrate. You're not trying to prevent freedom. You're not trying to control them. Quite to the contrary, you want them to become independent, you want them to become successful, and they are in charge of how much freedom they get based on their behavior. When we do that, we're going to really do discipline the right way, which is teaching, not control.
Now, by the way, that's fine until you hit the schools. What do you do with who's got the most control? You got schools now giving away condoms. You know, there's kids that can get abortions without their parents knowing it. How do you maintain control? And this is a question. I'm not trying to get on the opposite side of the issue here. It's a question. How do you gain that kind of confidence and control with those children if they have all of those abilities and they can do anything they want to do once they're away from you, once they step foot out of that house?
So it's about trust. When it comes to monitoring your child, we actually know a lot. It's not as simple as asking them what they're doing, where they're going, who they're going to be with, because kids have a choice about what they disclose to you. They absolutely have a choice. And what you want, no matter what else is out there in the world, whatever resources are out there, you want to make sure that they come to you first for values, you first when they're in trouble, you first when they need advice. And there are ways of parenting, and letting go with love and confidence covers a lot of these ways, so that you will actually be the first person who's monitoring them. And one of the most important things when we're talking about parenting style is to be the kind of parent who actually gives kids both roots and wings. So you're a balanced parenting style. You say, I love you, I trust you, I enjoy spending good time with you. I want to give you firm roots. I want to give you also wings so you can try things out. But for the things that really matter, you're going to have to listen to what I say. That's the kind of parenting that has been proven, that balanced style of parenting has been proven not only to protect kids around a whole bunch of risk behaviors, but it has also been proven to keep kids talking to us. So my answer to the question you posed is not about what should be out there in the world, because I'm about giving parents power. Giving parents the power to have effective relationships with their children so they won't need to rebel and so that we are the ones who are going to be able to give our values. And we know how to do that. And that's a lot about of what this book's about.
Let me tell you with this will never happen in a dream world. But let me tell you what I would love to see happen, Ken. I would love to see that if you're going to have a baby, you'd have to get a license, all right? And part of that license was you had to go to school and you had to prep yourself for what's coming, and a book like this should be part and parcel of the training. Now, we know you're not going to get a license to have a baby, and none of this will ever happen. But the problem is most parents go into parenting and have no idea what a parent is. And then once you go through the process and you've had your ups and your downs and your whatever, and you get a little bit of feel of how to do it, it's never too late. But at the same time, why can't you get something that'll allow you to anticipate the problems beforehand? Eliminate some of the problems before they even happen and create that respect before they go out into the world. And it's going to take you, it's going to be 10 times harder to get your point across.
Well, I think it would be terrific if we did have parenting classes for everybody. I think that that's a great ideal, but it's never going to happen.
Nah.
So therefore, what we have to rely on is communities. And that's something else that's breaking down. That's one of the big problems we have now in America, is that everybody's starting over and parents are needing to learn through their own mistakes, which is going to take them 10 or 12 years or their first child of them doing, you know, less effective parenting than they wanted to. And the benefit of the community, of having the aunt down the street or the grandma across town or the next door neighbor who you felt you could really talk to about your children without feeling judged, that's what is leaving us in modern day America. One of the feels that we try to create in Letting Go with Love and Confidence, my co-author Susan Fitzgerald is a reporter, and she interviewed scores of people from around the country, so that this book about how to let go in a comfortable way, how to honor independence one step at a time, dealing with all of the whens, all those everyday issues that come up in parenting, we have not just my opinion, we have the opinion of scores of parents that are a diverse group of people from across the country to give you that kind of home feel of advice that's currently missing.
I would venture to guess that the responsibility for gangs today lies on parents, because if you're not accepted at home, if you don't have, I'm going to use the word identity at home, you're going to go out and find it someplace else. And you're going to find people who are going to accept you. And in many cases, Ken, that going out and killing somebody to show everybody that you're part of the gang and you want to be accepted and you've got an identity is worth that shorter life.
Well, you know, I actually work with quite a few gang kids in my capacity of working with homeless and street youth. And
yeah.
What I will tell you is that virtually every behavior that we fear in adolescence, whether it's gangs or doing drugs or having sex inappropriately or cutting or eating disorders, all of these are kids reaching for something that they don't have or dealing or coping with uncomfortable feelings. Those kids who are in gangs are kids who care intensely about loyalty, and they're actually looking for belonging. So you're actually right on target. But another thing that we cover pretty intensively in the book is stress reduction. Parenting is not just about telling kids what not to do. We have to, with just as much conviction and force, tell kids what to do. There are wonderful ways of dealing with stress. We can't take away stress from kids. We wish we could. You know, having a kid is like having your heart on the outside of your body, I always say. It's certainly the way I feel with my own girls. So vulnerable. But I can't protect them from everything in the world, but I can teach them how to cope so they won't need to reach for those easy, quick fixes, or, you know, the one you chose isn't easy at all, but they don't have to reach for the gang to find belonging and connection because it's everywhere in our home.
And that makes sense. And Ken, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Sure. Fosteringresilience.com. Just fosteringresilience.com. It also has a lot of kind of free downloads on the 7 C's model of resilience, which I created for the American Academy of Pediatrics, lots of information, not just about the books.
Wonderful. Hey, Ken Ginsberg, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for your time and efforts.
Take care. Good night.
You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm lost.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Terry Morrison with us, co-author of Kiss, Bow, or Shake Hands, Sales and Marketing. He's the co-author of 9 books, including The Kiss, Bow, and Shake Hands, the best-selling guide to doing business in more than 60 countries. And he's been on the Journal Best Business Book winner and an American... Terry, welcome to the show. I got to tell you, I'm going to write a book called Once You've Blown the Intro, the rest of the show's got to be great.
Thank you much. It's a pleasure to be here, Michael Ray.
Hey, thank you. By the way, when I think the book in and of itself, Kiss, Bow, or Shake Hands, Sales and Marketing Essential Guide, And we are talking about when you're dealing in a global marketplace. Terry, the way we do business here is not the way we do business in another country. And I think that in and of itself is one of the biggest problems businesses today in America have. They don't know how to compete.
True. And when your domestic market is saturated with your own product, you don't have a choice. You have to go elsewhere. So if you're going to look at the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, each of those four have different things that occur in the first few minutes of the meeting or throughout the negotiating process or the protocol of business entertaining. There are a lot of complexities.
Yeah, and by the way, because we have a certain way of communicating, we have a certain meaning on the words that we use, doesn't necessarily mean that they do. Now, when you're dealing globally, when you're dealing with an international market, where was it for you that you had to sit back and say, it's not just the same, there's not one shoe fits all here, and there's got to be a tremendous amount of learning before you set foot onto another country and try to do business?
True. Just getting there is so expensive that you've already, as soon as you step foot there, invested thousands of dollars in your marketing materials. And what if you used the wrong logo or color or the layout of your materials is wrong because perhaps they read from right to left instead of left to right? So you have an advertising campaign that actually communicates the reverse of what you want. Like a pharmaceutical company had a graphic element that showed a very depressed man on the left, and then they had their antidepressant in the center of the ad, and then the face was smiling on the right-hand side of the ad, like, oh, he took the pill and now he feels great. And that's terrific if you read left to right. But if you read right to left, like Arabic, Hebrew, parts of China, Japan still have their script runs from right to left in signs and so forth. They're seeing a perfectly happy man who took your product, and now look at him. He's blue.
Yeah, love
so,
it. True, yeah. So it's like the Nutrisystem.
So that could happen.
Like the Nutrisystem ad, you see a woman that's 80, 90, 100 pounds overweight, and she's got this very depressed, solemn look on her face. And the right-hand side screen, there she is with all that weight gone with a big smile. And, you know, the instantaneous aha, the solution to a problem here. But if you reverse it, hadn't thought about it that way, and if you don't know your market and the structure behind their communication, you could be in big trouble and you could have the greatest advertising in the world.
You're right. The before and after pictures, that's brilliant. That's a perfect example. And that's very common in the U.S. We also use different types of ads here than they're not even permitted in many parts of the EU. For example, you can't have comparative advertising. Even in Canada, you're not allowed to advertise directly to children in Quebec anymore. So if you want to sell toys, you have to gear the ad to the parents. And there are all kinds of permutations in any country that is Hindu or Muslim, because they won't have a man and a woman alone in an advertisement. They don't, for example, in the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, has so many conferences all year long, every day. It's a huge hub for conferences. And you have to think, well, I can't have my normal ads that depict people alone, and I can't have ads perhaps for pepperoni or hot dogs or things that are prohibited by Islam because they're pork products. They're made from pigs. So those things can't fly. So there's all sorts of permutations that you should have vetted before you go there, not just your marketing materials, but even how you greet them, what foods you expect to eat, whether they're going to invite you to dinner, and is alcohol prohibited, or are they going to be like South Koreans and expect you to drink pretty well, you know?
Yeah. And Terry, I think this is, especially in today's marketplace, this is not the local marketplace anymore. Everything we touch is international today. And if somebody's going to be in business, if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you're going to be a corporation, whatever the case may be, If you don't have a handle on this, you might as well quit before you start. You may go in, and from what you're saying, you may go in with all the greatest intentions in the world. But if you don't know how they see you and what can insult them that might make somebody across a country line happy, you're in trouble. You could get killed out there.
Oh, you could, and you could also have a situation where, even though people say, well, the world is more connected, we have the Internet, cultural differences are so huge a reality that the Internet, I think, is speeding up the rate of intercommunications difficulties, because you could have a taboo subject, and that doesn't just stop an individual sale for you, but it'll prohibit an entire country from seeing your Google ad. They'll just, you know, prohibit the access because it's culturally or politically offensive. For example, you know, more than 1 billion consumers were blocked from seeing Google because the Chinese government deemed them politically incorrect for having the Tiananmen Square data on there. And the UAE will, and Saudi Arabia will ban sites that have content that's inappropriate under Islam. And even Turkey blocked a lot of sites because the content insulted Kemal Ataturk, who was their political leader. So you have to think, gee, I really have to be more careful now than historically, when the only time you would have a face-to-face time would be when you're physically present. Now you can Skype them, or they can see your website, decide you're inappropriate, and block you.
And by the way, the other side of that, too, is there are so many things in the Middle East, the European countries, etc., that when you're doing business, if you want to be competitive with them, there are costs that they do not have incorporated into their end result of a product that they would manufacture that we might have here, which would make us completely non-competitive. There's international taxation. There are so many things, factors, variables that are involved that most people don't take a look at. Well, I got a great product. I'm going to be all over the world with it. Not quite.
Right.
Yeah.
You're right. There are some excellent websites that the U.S. government actually has that gives you those trade resources, so that before you say, well, I'm just going on all of these trips, you want to make sure you have the, you could even go to buyusa.gov. That's a really large, excellent site that has trade promotion. It's a unit of the International Trade Administration. This is all free data, and it's very deep. And you could go through some of these aspects of the search. That's in one of the appendices to the book, and figure out, this is a great market, perhaps in Mexico, whereas it wouldn't be in Chile or Argentina. So, just because of the type of product, the way that you approach it, the proximity to your production, like you were saying, it could be cheaper to do it in one environment than another, and you just have to go to these websites now and put in a bit of data, and it helps tremendously.
Oh, sure. There's another area to take into consideration, too. I noticed you touch on neuromarketing also. You know, those... Yeah, the somatic markers, obviously, you know, the what we may look at here differently, the Nutrisystem ad, the happy and the sad, those are markers. Those are things placed intentionally to trigger a recognition, which will trigger a buying response. Now, what happens here effectively may not happen in another country, because the neural marketing that will work here, you said it with the reverse of the left to right to the right to the left, would, if you try to implement what we would use here, could be totally devastating somewhere else.
Japan's an excellent example of that, because neuromarketers analyzed where you look on a face in an ad, and many Asian cultures and some Latin cultures are trained not to look directly into your eyes. They don't have prolonged eye contact when you're face-to-face. And so if you're trying to sell mascara to women on a subway, perhaps in Japan, you have a very few seconds for that digital ad to appear. And how are you going to get them to look at the eyes to see the mascara's effect? You have to put the tube of mascara right next to the face where you want to have their eye drawn, because usually they'll look at the bridge of the nose, and they do an inversion of the triangle, so that where we would look immediately directly in, with your foveal vision right into the pupils of the person, some cultures don't do that at all.
No, and then you're talking about your verbal and your nonverbal communication. You know, the conscious-unconscious mind. I've seen ads that constantly that what they'll do is they'll take your conscious mind and set it aside while what they're saying is going right into that unconscious mind, and they will set something up for you to look at. And if you look at, I'm going to get that tad risque, excuse me, but you see this constantly. If you look at most of the ads that you see in America on television, you will see a woman with a great-looking rear end. I'm sorry, but you'll see a woman with a great-looking rear end, and while your eyes are there, the message that you're feeding, they're feeding you, is going right beyond that conscious mind and that analytical sense of evaluation, which causes you to accept or reject something, and it goes right into that unconscious mind as a goal to achieve, and people buy because of that.
Yes, it's rather primal the way you state it, but actually it also works on YouTube with puppies, you know, and you'll see kittens and puppies, and those are triggers, you're right. And sometimes you'll get very provincial environments that don't use that kind of advertising. They want data, they want content. Germans love a lot of technical information in an ad. However, if you go to France, it's all about the sex in the ad. Yeah. And they don't have the prohibitions that we do. So, I mean, in comparison to France, we're rather tame.
Yeah, but
even
if it's
in comparison to Saudi Arabia, we're wild.
Yeah, and if it wasn't just sex, it was just something that causes you to look at something while the message is being fed in. The subliminal marketing, which they stopped, I think it was in Canada they stopped it first. You could walk into any store, and in the, you know, with the elevator music underneath it would be saying, buy a certain product. You wouldn't hear it, but yes, you would. And there were tons of people purchasing product because of it, and they finally outlawed it. You get a little bit of it here, but not quite as bad as it used to be.
Right. They do not allow those pop-up call now things in France, because the French, again, don't like overt sales. They enjoy a sort of an intuitive ad, one where you have to make that leap of logic yourself, because that's more entertaining. Or they like slapstick, like Molière rather than Manhattan over here, where we would say, call now, buy this, you have 10 seconds or something. They don't like that kind of advertising. But it's interesting how you could take the one product, and if you know how to approach the market in each environment and the motivating factors in different cultures, whether it's family or dogma in China or the consensus-based group environment in a culture like Japan, you can penetrate a market pretty well with one single product with different packaging.
No, and by the way, I've got the book in my hand. It's Keeper. What you've got here is in some of the chapters of the, you know, how to sell what, it's the English and the French, and in the different chapters, whatever country that you're in. And those are those certain words that you just have to know. I like the way you've done this. This is really good.
Thank you so much. It took 2 years.
Yeah, it was good. What's coming next? Because this looks like it's just going to give you that beginning for something more coming.
Well, actually, this is based on a concept from the vice president at McGraw-Hill, who's a friend of mine. He was around when I did my first book, Kiss, Bower, Shake Hands, the big book, and that is easily twice as large as this book. So it's become a series now, and we might do something. I'm not sure which direction, but you know what's interesting is the social media environment in different countries and how it's viewed differently and how it's approached, integrated into education even. As it's, you know, the United States, we're just allowing electronic devices now into classrooms, and many environments still ban them because they're afraid of what the students will do with them. But it's so commonplace. I mean, South Korea has a goal to be completely paperless, no paper at all, by 2015 in all of their schools. So we have to catch up, and part of that is the social media. So I'm not sure, but something to do with technology, probably.
Mm, good. Okay, we're just about out of time. Terry, I could talk to you all night about this stuff. It's absolutely phenomenal. Is there a website we can find you at, get the book, and get more information?
Absolutely. TerryMorrison.com or KissBowerShakeHands.com. And we have free quizzes and articles and blogs, and we're cooking. So I hope you visit.
And by the way, you know what I just found? Terry Morrison, president of Getting Through Customs, the developer of the McGraw-Hill Kiss, Bow, and Shake Hands digital product. And she and Wayne A. Conway are co-authors of 9 books, including Library Journal, Best Business Books, Winner Kiss, Bow, and Shake Hands, and Dun & Bradstreet's Guide to Doing Business Around the World. I bet you never got an intro at the end of a show before, have you?
Great close. Thank you so much, Michael.
Terry, thank you so much for being with us. Good night.
Good night. Take care. Bye-bye.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And a 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Radio Susie's rocking there.
I'm ready.
She's ready. Okay.
Ready.
Let's do it. Nina's ready. Nina.
I'm ready.
Hey. Oh, Nina, I'm so glad you're ready. Okay. We're going to be talking about writing books and how to write a book. First, a blogging book, why authors need to blog. And, by the way, is the workbook out now, how to evaluate your book for success?
Yes, the workbook is out. How to evaluate your book for success is out on my website, but how to blog a book, I am very pleased to say, is not published yet, but you can pre-order it on Amazon.
Oh, good.
Woohoo.
Okay, now, It's set up for the pre-sale, and it'll be available now when?
On Amazon, it says May, but the publisher tells me April. So if you to Amazon and you plug in, I've been putting in my name. So if you put in Nina Amir, but I guess you could put in how to blog a book, it will come up without even a cover at this point. But it's there, and you can actually click to buy it, and you won't have it delivered until April or May, but you can order one now.
Oh, which is,
cool.
I got a question.
That?
Oh, it's cooler than you can imagine, because I know the kind of work that you do. My goodness. Hey, let me ask a question before we get into the expo that you were just at. I have a question about publishing. There's something called self-publishing, right?
Yep.
Now, can you help people with that?
Yes, I am not one of these experts who leads them hand by hand through all aspects of self-publishing, but I do consult with people and help them in some aspects of that. I will tell them, you know, what they need to do and get them on their way. But there are other people who I could put them in touch with who will take them through every aspect of it if they want their hand held, you know, through all of it. I'm actually teaching a workshop this weekend in Monterey on how to write a short book fast, where I will tell them, give them lots of tips on, you know, how to get their book self-published. I'm not one of these consultants who that's really what I do, is all aspects of self-publishing.
No, because I just sent somebody to you.
Okay. Well, no, I can help them.
Yeah, no, I got that. If anybody else hears that, at least, you know, we have the magic. It's like in the industry. I don't know everything. I don't. But after all these years, I have a Rolodex. That's the magic. You know where to go to get what you want. Okay, let's talk about...
I have self-published in different formats 9 different books. Mm. So, yes, I know about self-publishing, but I would not call myself the expert on the actual nitty-gritty of self-publishing.
Yeah, well,
expertise is writing and editing.
Yeah, well, the word around the industry is, if Michael Ray doesn't know, his Rolodex does.
That's right. So that is what I would say. I can do a whole lot of the self-publishing, you know, help you with a whole lot of the self-publishing steps, but what I don't know, I can open my Rolodex and I can give you someone else who will do the rest of it for you.
Love it. Okay, let's talk about the expo that you just got back. It sounded good, and you sounded excited about what you got out of it.
I had the best time there, and I learned so much. It was called Blog World and New Media Expo, and it was down in Los Angeles. They used to do it, I think, in Vegas, and they now have split it up into it's Blog World and New Media Expo West and East. So there's one in L.A. and one in New York. This one was November 3rd and 5th in Los Angeles, and there's one coming up in New York in June 5th through 7th. And this thing was huge. I mean, huge. There were, what did they tell me? Something like, I'm trying to find a statistic, something like, they generated, the people who were there, because they were all bloggers, right? Bloggers and social media people. And on the first day, on November 3rd, the attendees generated over 16,000 posts on social media. And they gave me statistics. Blog World attendees have a combined monthly online audience of 250 million people, and that's just their blog audience.
Wow.
And they generated more than 400 million online conversations during the course of the expo.
Unbelievable.
Isn't that amazing? They had in attendance, it was like their biggest show ever, they had in attendance 4,000 people from 30 countries. And they had over 300 speakers.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
It was huge.
Yeah.
It was huge. And all the biggest people that, you know, I can think of in social media and blogging were there. And I got to meet some of them.
I just
learned a ton, and it was super.
Did you run into Lon Safko by chance?
Who?
No, that's all right. With the 400,000 people, whatever, Lon Safko.
No.
Oh, okay. Lon's very big in social media, so he was probably there. But I can't imagine why you two didn't bump into each other. Not that there was
no. Well, with 4,000 people, it was hard. When we're done, I'll go look at the list of speakers and see if he was there speaking.
And he could have been, because he's major in that. Let me ask you this. Can anybody, and I know this is, it sounds like such a simple question, but it's not. Can anybody start a blog?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much anyone can start a blog. And, you know, there was a woman there from Technorati, and Technorati is this blog cataloger. You know, it's this organization online that catalogs blogs, and she was there to talk about their State of the Blogosphere report. Every year they do this survey, and she was showing how many, you know, all the different kinds of blogs that are out there and who's doing the blogging. And, you know, it's amazing to know who all's blogging. And 61% of the people they surveyed were just hobbyists, just people with a passion about something that were blogging. And that, to me, is an amazing number, you know, that 60, I mean, they only, of the people they surveyed, it was only like 4,114 people who responded to the survey. But of those people, more than half are just people who are passionate about a topic, and they're blogging. So, yes, anyone can start a blog.
All right. Now, by the way, when you start a blog, the blog in and of itself is just anything you want to really write about, isn't it?
It is.
And the benefit of starting a blog.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and the benefit of starting a blog, could that start somebody out on a writing career if they've never done anything before? Just that first indication that, yes, I can do something.
It could, because a lot of writers, you know, have not been published, and for them, a blog is a way to be published. Because when you, matter of fact, at one point, in one of the big keynote sessions, they said, "How many of you are bloggers? Raise your hand. How many of you are publishers?" And if you were a blogger, you should have also raised your hand if you were a publisher, because bloggers publish their work. Every time you write a post, to make it public, you hit a little button that says publish, and you publish your work on the internet. And so for writers, this is a way for them to get their writing out there and read, and to begin to get a following, you know, a readership, and fans of their work. And, you know, as we've talked about before, it's a way to build an author platform. And one of the, you know, and so for that, that's important if you want to publish a book later, because today publishers, you know, the publishing houses, the acquisition editors at publishing houses, they're looking for writers who have some kind of a track record, some kind of, you know, something that proves that they have readers and that somebody will buy that book eventually when it's published. And so a blogger with readers and subscribers to their blog is kind of a proven quantity to these publishers. So that's great. You know, that's something that the publishers are looking for. But beyond that, Technorati also showed that bloggers are having huge influence in the world at large. You know, people are reading blogs to see what these bloggers are saying and what their opinions are about everything, including brands and products, now, you know?
Now, by the way, blogging could be like having a party and you're upset because nobody showed up because you didn't send out the invitations for people to get there. So the key is you can blog, but how do you get traffic? How do you drive traffic to that blog to get the readers?
So, you know, the main thing is to write really great content, to write about something on a consistent basis and to write well. And, of course, using keywords is important, you know, these search, you know, words that are searchable, that people are searching for, but you don't want to do that in a way that is stilted or unnatural. You want to do it because these are the words you're using, because you're on topic, because you're writing targeted content. But if you write consistently and often, then you will begin to work your way up in the search engines, and so people will find you if they're searching for your topic. Besides that, if you are using social networks like Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and now Google+, and you're writing something about each one of your posts and putting the link in there so people can click on it and go through to your blog, that's going to drive traffic to your site. I would say those are the two best ways to do it. Yeah, really, so in my experience.
So in essence, but I want to go back to content of a blog. A writer doesn't just become a writer. There's a skill to writing. There is a technique to writing, because once you start writing, you've got to have that end user, that reader, involved in it, experiencing themselves in it, and on and on. So when somebody starts to write a blog, can you teach somebody to write a blog? I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that would love to be able to write about a particular topic, but for some reason they can't form it or shape it in such a way that it'll keep an audience glued to them. Do you give blog training?
I do. I work with writers on their blogs and you know, in terms of their content, how to write more compelling blog posts and how to, you know, of course, because I do How to Blog a Book, you know, because that's my blog is about how to blog a book and that's what my book is. I talk to them actually about how to take a whole concept, a book concept, and turn it into a blog. But there is this whole concept of how to get your blog readers to engage. And I had a very interesting conversation while I was at the expo with a woman, Liz Strauss. And Liz has, she has something like 94,000 comments on her blog. This is an enormous amount of comments.
Wow. Yeah.
And I interviewed her, and I asked Liz, you know, how do you do that? How do you get people engaged in that way? Because that's what you want with a blog. Is a blog really should be a back and forth. And she talked about that, about how she asks questions, and how blogs should be sort of open ended. They're not always such a finished piece. You know, a lot of the blogs I write are informative. They're how to pieces. You know, how to do this, how to do that, how to get published, how to write a query letter, how to do social networking, how to attract an agent, how to blog a book. But I have another blog where, you know, I might mull over something. I have a blog called As the Spirit Moves Me, and there I might be mulling over something more spiritual or related to human potential. And in those kind of situations, it's more along the lines of what Liz was talking about, where you might be talking about something and leave it open and ask a question. I actually could be doing it on my other blogs, and I actually am going to start implementing what she talked about, where you're kind of thinking about something and talking about something, and then you ask, you know, what do you think? But not just what do you think. I mean, better, you can come up with compelling questions to ask your readers so that they want to comment, so they want to engage with you in a conversation. And that's the lovely thing about a blog, is it gives you an opportunity to engage in a conversation with your readers. And what writer has that opportunity? I mean, maybe in a critique group, but, you know, not really very often does a writer have an opportunity to engage in a conversation with their readers.
You know, you bring up an interesting point, because that's absolutely true. And it is. A conversation is really the complete power behind it. And you know what? It goes by so quick when we get on the air together. But we're starting to run out of time again. Okay. Website we can find you at.
So the place to go if you want to find, like, all my blogs and all of that would be ninaamir.com. So www.ninaamir.com. And if you click through, you can go to Copyright Communications and to How to Blog a Book and all those different things. It's all there at ninaamir.com.
I'm going to be talking to you tomorrow sometime, because I'm going to, what you ask me to do, I will do with happiness.
You will
think
do
about
what?
What you emailed me and asked me to do.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
That.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Good night.
Good night. Good night. I'll talk to you next week.
Okay.
And a love's burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore from now and evermore. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give.
A dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms. I know the magic of her charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. As I grow old, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Costas Baniatakis with us. He is the author of the upcoming book, Remaking Scarcity from Capitalist Inefficiency to Economic Democracy. He teaches sociology at New York City College of Technology. He's published on political economy, ecology, and social movement, and has been interviewed in numerous radio TV programs in the United States and abroad. He is the book review editor of the international journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism. Costas, I welcome to the show.
Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, and thank you so much. Did I pronounce your name, your last name properly?
Yeah, Panagiotakis.
Ah, Panagiotakis. I got it. Okay, great. Now, by the way, when we look at capitalism today, in your world, through your eyes, define what you experience capitalism to be.
Yeah, capitalism, of course, is characterized by the private property of businesses and, of course, the reliance on markets. And the markets are all pervasive, including, you know, market for labor, for land. And what this means, when you put all these elements of the capitalist system together, this system gives the people who control businesses a lot of power over the future of humanity, the future of our culture, the future of our planet.
Now, we look at Greece today, you know, and obviously Greece's cabinet just voted to support a referendum on the latest bailout plan. How would we compare Greece to what we're doing here in the United States economically?
Yeah, Greece is facing a very deep crisis that is part of the broader global capitalist crisis. So, I mean, there are parallels in the crisis in the two countries, and then their specificities. Things are much worse in Greece. I mean, things are very bad here. We are talking here about 9% unemployment, but in Greece it's 18.4%. The U.S. historically is one of the most, you know, economically powerful industrialized countries. Greece historically has been, in recent years, was better than most parts of the world, but now it is facing very difficult circumstances. There is a brutal assault on the living conditions of ordinary Greeks.
Yeah.
And I think the part of the difference between Greece and the U.S. has to do with the fact that capitalism as a global system has always been characterized by uneven development, where some countries are very wealthy, others are less so. And this difference partly has to do with the ability of more wealthy countries to take advantage in various ways the less economically advanced and powerful countries.
Now, economic democracy, and I'm going to read this from your press release because I think it's an important thing to take a look at. Defined as the ability of all citizens to have equal voice over the operation and priorities of the economy. Is that possible? And when I say is that possible, it takes a certain mindset. It takes a certain skill to be able to run an economy. That doesn't mean everybody it gets in the right hands all the time. But I'll go all the way back to when we became a nation here. We had people who were, it was agrarian. We had people who were farmers. They couldn't read, they couldn't write. So they had to leave the economy and the policies up to people who had those skills. Whether they had the ability to really work in favor of everybody or not, it's a story, obviously, it's debatable. But when we're dealing with an entire population that has the ability of all citizens to have an equal voice over the operation and priorities of the economy, is that something that, and this is just a question, neither side of this for me, is that something, Costas, that is a reality, that is a pragmatic, a practical reality? Is that something that could happen?
Well, I think this objection to democracy goes back a long way, and people voice the same objection for political democracy, even using the argument against the idea that every citizen should have a vote, whether they be, you know, rich or poor, educated or not educated. So I think by now we sort of recognize that, you know, we shouldn't discriminate against people and say you cannot vote because, you know, you don't have a college degree or you haven't finished high school or whatever. And I think the same should be said about the economy, because the economy, the way the economy is set up, has as much influence, if not more, on people's everyday lives as the political system. And in any case, I think this is a principle that we can use as an ideal, and we can see it as a challenge, and we can think of ways of ways that can move us in that direction. Because what we have now is a system where this is not the case, where few people make decisions that affect the lives of everybody else. And what we see with the current crisis is that oftentimes these decisions are disastrous for society and, of course, the planet more broadly. And the people who make the disastrous decisions will oftentimes get rewarded with bailouts and so on and so forth. And everybody else will be, who's not responsible, will be expected to pay the price for the sins of others. So capitalism is not a democratic economic system, and because of that, it creates all kinds of economic, social, ecological problems. So in my view, to get away of these problems, we need to think of ways of moving towards economic democracy. And of course, in my book, I also discuss what would that mean, what kind of society might that involve. There is a debate there. I consider different possibilities, and then, of course, I discuss how we could move in that direction, including referring to practices that exist in our world today, things like democratically run factories in Argentina, which proliferated in the last 10 years after a crisis there that is in some way similar to what we're experiencing today, or practices like participatory budgeting, which basically means that ordinary citizens meet with each other, they have assemblies, and they decide what, you know, public spending should be devoted to. Should it be, you know, a clinic in the neighborhood, or should it be a sewage system, or should it be a school system? And what studies show is that this way of determining public spending basically empowers people much more, especially groups of people who are historically oppressed and disenfranchised. It empowers them more than the traditional way of determining public spending, which is based on the decisions of bureaucrats or politicians who are oftentimes answered to rich people who fund their campaigns.
No question about it. And I see, by the way, what you're saying, I would completely go along with. When we talk about public spending, that's the way that we're supposed to be here. If we have not a bureaucrat is somebody who is a paid employee of the government they weren't elected in. But the elected officials are supposed to be a reflection of the will of the people. Everybody can't get up and say, this is what I want to do, because it'll be too confusing when you've got hundreds of millions of people that inhabit a particular country like the United States. So we bring in the politicians. The politicians are supposed to do what's best for us. Somewhere they got off track and we have the mess that we're in now. And I think we've got to make a decision, or not a decision, a distinction between corporations and politicians. I know we have lobbyists, and I know that many politicians move in particular ways because of money that they get from the lobbyists and the major corporations. But there is a tremendous amount of money spent by government that's not corporations. The bailouts for General Motors, the bailouts for the bank, the bailouts for, my goodness, I mean, they're just hundreds of billions of dollars every time we turn around. The government's giving somebody something. And I think this last action with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the billions of dollars that we gave to them for the bailout, and you've got the people who run it. I think there was 12 of the administrators getting packages of over $1 million apiece, et cetera, et cetera. So somewhere we broke down, and we have people who are running the government that are running their own government without the will of the people. And I'm almost wondering whether we should point our fingers at corporations or those people that are involved in the everyday operation of running the country.
Well, I think in my view, in a capitalist society, the power primarily runs is in the hands of those who control the economy. And controlling the economy means they control investment. So if you may have a government that is very well-meaning and it is elected with a mandate to do things that will equalize opportunities for the majority of the citizens. But then if these decisions go against the interests of capitalists, they can go into what is known as an investment strike. They decide, I'm not going to invest money, I'm going to take my money elsewhere. And guess what will happen? Then the economy will start going south. And this will mean that the politicians, if they are democratically elected, will very soon find themselves in trouble, because once the economy goes down, everybody will blame them. So what does that mean? It means that in a capitalist society, you have a small economic elite that has veto power over, you know, decisions that affect the future of all of us. And you know, this is not a good situation. And the other thing, of course, since we've been talking about bailouts, is you know, the sort of spectacle of just a couple of years ago, the government bailing out financial institutions and Wall Street, and then they had the nerve to use the profits they made from the bailouts to lobby against financial regulation, and they watered down the financial regulation, and down the line we may have a similar or even worse financial crisis because we haven't adopted the kind of regulation that it would take to prevent the same thing from happening in the future.
In a practical sense, how do we go about doing this? How do you implement what you're saying? And by the way, I can't argue it, I can't debate it, because of my own belief system, we're very close. But how do you implement that kind of a system when you have a structure that's already in force, and you just can't walk in and say, okay, it's over now, we're going to change everything around. You got the trillions of dollars here in particular that we're in debt. How do you turn this around? How do you create it in such a way that it goes back into the hands of the people?
Yeah, I mean, I have a chapter towards the end of my book where I talk about the question of strategy. But, I mean, as a first step, on the most basic level, people have to fight for these changes. And so that's the first thing. Any time you want to have positive change that benefits the majority of the population, you need to have movements that push for that. Beyond that, what kind of form does the fight take? It can take the form of, as I was saying, trying to create alternative economic spaces that work against the logic of profit and they are democratic. So as I talked about, you know, the democratically run factories. These were factories that were abandoned during the crisis in Argentina, and workers took them over, and they had to fight really long against the police who tried to evict them, and to lobby politicians, put pressure on them, get support from the community, just to recognize the right to run these factories democratically. And so that's one of the of the strategies, to create alternative autonomous spaces that do not follow the logic of profit, but they are democratically run. And the other side of the strategy is we have to try to democratize the state, in other words, to pursue reforms and changes that reduce inequality and that increase the accountability of the government to the people. So there is a long history of struggles along those lines. Every time people struggle for more union rights, they are struggling for more equality, they are struggling for more of a say for working people in the workplace, but also in the political system. Every time we struggle for reform, for sort of changes in policy that reduce racial inequality and gender inequality, these are also fights for economic democracy, because you cannot have economic democracy where everybody has equal say over the operation of the economy when you have racism and sexism that prevents large segments of the population from being recognized as being equal. So many of the sort of progressive changes and struggles and reform that we have are consistent with this struggle for economic democracy. But one of the differences, one of the things we have to realize, is that we need economic democracy. We need to go beyond capitalism, because anytime we win anything within capitalism, anytime we win progressive changes, these changes are always subject to reversal. They are precarious. And that's what we're seeing today. There were, you know, progressive changes that happened after, you know, during the New Deal era. Workers, you know, spilled rivers of blood to get basic changes. And these have been gradually eroded. There was regulation of the financial system, but under the influence of the Wall Street, it was repealed, leading to the current financial crisis. The world strong unions are in the process of being eroded and attacked. So it's not enough to try to make the system a little more humane. We have to go beyond the system, because anything that we gain within the system is subject to reversal.
No question. Costas, I hate to do this. We're running out of time. We're going to have you back on. But for now, can we get your website so we can get the book and get more information?
Well, the publisher is Pluto Press, and the American distributor is Palgrave Macmillan. So it's Remaking Scarcity, Costas Panagiotakis, you know.
Wonderful. Okay, Costas, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
Off comes the makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out. As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is
a wrap.
And as the moment ends, got a funny feeling.